Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, Echo Brown tells us why Black virgins are not for hipsters.
You know, there's a lot of people who have these like random mustaches. I see that around San Francisco and these big beards and trying to make a statement and really feeling like they are liberal and part of the culture. But I have experienced hipsters that are very privileged and unaware of their privilege.
Today on Inflection Point, solo performer Echo Brown. Revealing your most intimate secrets is usually reserved for a best friend or a therapist, a memoir or a personal diary. Our guest, Echo Brown, is a writer, performer, and playwright whose one-woman show, Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters, tells all to an audience of strangers. Theater critics have called Echo a transformational storyteller, a powerhouse performer, and a phenom. Through her extremely personal storytelling, Echo Brown provides a contemporary history of being a Black woman in America, challenging all assumptions and letting her audiences in on a few major secrets. Welcome to the program, Echo Brown.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the show and why you chose the title Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters.
Yeah, so I started working on this show about 2 years ago, and I initially thought I was going to make a fun show about dating and how much it sucks in the Bay Area. So I went to Marsh, which is kind of the hub of solo performance, and I started working with David Ford there. And it just kind of developed over the past 2 years. And the reason that I chose the title Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters is because it, you know, it's kind of a commentary on hipster culture. It's kind of a critique of that. And you'll see that in the show, how I critique that culture. And it also very much has to do with my love interest, who was a Brooklyn hipster from Portland, Oregon. So it's kind of all those things wrapped up in the title. And it just feels very relevant. And it just feels like, you know, a lot of people gravitate towards that title.
Well, I was thinking about the term hipsters the other day because I was around when there were yuppies, you know, and there's everyone. It feels like every generation has some kind of designation for that group.
Yeah.
So how, I mean, how would you describe what a hipster is?
You know, I think some people have different definitions, but I would describe hipsters as primarily young people. They can be of all races. I've met, you know, young Black hipsters, young Asian hipsters. You know, people who kind of see themselves as living on the fringe, and they wear this, you know, these really stylish, ridiculous clothes that they get from the Goodwill, but they look very well tailored. You know, there's a lot of people who have these like random mustaches. I see that around San Francisco and these big beards and trying to make a statement and really feeling like they are liberal and part of the culture, but they may not necessarily be owning that from a place of how they actually act in the real world. So they're, I have experienced hipsters that are very privileged and unaware of their privilege, but still wanting to kind of be in the vein of, you know, I'm liberal, I get it, when they may not actually get it.
And you would define yourself as not a hipster?
Well, you know, I have hipster tendencies.
You don't have a mustache.
I don't. I have some hipster clothes. I have some hipster boots. I may be a little, you know, envious of the hipster culture. But I would say that I'm not a hipster just because I live these realities. So it's not like I'm trying to pretend to be poor. I come from a poor family. A lot of hipsters pretend to be poor for whatever reason. So no, but I do borrow some hipster things.
Well, throughout the show, we do learn a lot about your life and influences like Beyonce and Mister from The Color Purple. And I mean, two diametrically opposed in some senses, but clearly there's a connecting tissue there. Why did you pull on those two to talk about in the show?
Well, you know, Beyonce in particular is such a huge superstar now, and she really represents a lot for Black women. You know, a lot of people idolize her. Like, she is on this pedestal where not only is she beautiful, but she has all this power. She sets the rules. She does what she wants to do. So a lot of people are envious of that. So she has a lot of pull in the Black community, and she symbolizes a lot in the Black community. But at the same time, she also, you know, in a lot of ways still represents white beauty. She's a Black woman, but she has European features. She has blonde hair. So I think that is a little bit controversial in the Black community in terms of who we choose to elevate and highlight in the entertainment industry. And then just Mr., I think, has traditionally in the Black community represented the oppression of Black women that happens sometimes in the community between Black women and Black men, and just how, you know, some Black women develop this kind of inner negative self-esteem about how they look, which comes from the media, which comes from Black men sometimes, which comes from all these different places. So the Mr. character kind of encapsulates that.
Can you remind us what, it's been a long time since I've seen The Color Purple, but what the role of Mr. was in that movie?
So he was the primary father figure in the movie of the two girls there, and he was very abusive towards him. And when she came out with The Color Purple all those years ago, it was very controversial because a lot of people said, why do you have to portray Black men like this?
And you talk about it in the show that you have an inner Mr.
And again, that's just symbolic. So in my head, I don't actually hear Mr. I'm not walking down the street and Mr. is talking to me.
Okay.
It's symbolic of the voices that are in my head. So if, you know, someday I have low self-esteem and I'm looking in the mirror and I don't like what I see and all these voices are, you're too ugly, you're not good enough, you'll never be good enough. So he kind of represents those forces within me.
Well, I did enjoy standing up and dancing like a white girl.
That's wonderful.
During your
<That's>
show.
Wonderful.
It was so great. I mean, let me just describe briefly and you can elaborate. It's your show, but as the audience member watching Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters, about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes in, we're just getting warmed up to your show. You actually ask everyone in the audience to stand up and nobody did at first, which clearly you were prepared for because you said, no, really.
Right.
Get up.
Yeah.
And we did. And then there was some dancing that happened.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, I've never been to a show where that's happened unexpectedly like that. So what was the impetus for bringing people in like that?
I like to make it interactive. You know, it changes the feel of the performance and makes it even more dynamic and multidimensional if people have to do some interactive thing with you. That wasn't initially part of the show. So initially, I would demonstrate all of the Beyoncé dancing. And then somebody came up to me after the show and was like, you know, you should have the audience dance with you. And I was like, you know what? You're right. And it's been a big hit ever since. Like, I've never had people not stand up. The whole audience stands up, and we really have a good time with it.
Yeah.
And I think it really disarms people in a lot of ways, you know, because they get in their bodies and they're like, what's happening? And so it really kind of brings them into the performance in a much deeper way.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that you do in the show is you literally let your hair down. Is this a spoiler alert? I guess it's okay to say because
it's okay,
all right, on your website you've got two different looks going on. But about a third of the way through you whip off this adorable wig you've been wearing.
Yeah.
So what was going on with that?
That for me, that's another thing that's kind of a big thing in the Black community is you know, Black hair. And a big way that Black women are asked to assimilate is to straighten their hair or make it curly or wear fake hair to basically try to make it white hair, basically. That's what we're going for. So the wig, you know, it in the beginning, I wear it in the performance to just kind of, you know, you don't expect, it's like, oh, look at this cute girl with this nice hair, you know. And then when I take it off, it's shocking because my actual hair is short and it's nappy and it's very much Black. And people are always really shocked by that. And I thought it was important in a performance like this where I get so vulnerable and I reveal myself that that had to be revealed too. I couldn't give this whole big vulnerable, emotional performance about some of the roughest moments in my life and not reveal that.
Well, were you this self-aware growing up? Or did you have to come to this?
Self-awareness is a process. It has been a process for me. I was aware of certain things. I wasn't as aware as I am now in terms of the depth of my awareness. So now I understand conditioning. I understand that certain negative messages have been built into me. So when they come up, I can separate myself and understand what's happening. Whereas when I was younger and these negative messages would come up, I would just be spinning in it and just be the whole time just caught up in it. So I was always very self-aware, self-conscious, but I think the depth of my self-awareness has grown.
How much, just in terms of these negative messages, would you say, and maybe this is not an easy question to answer, but would be because of being female or because of being Black?
Yeah, it's, you know, that's a, there is no way to measure.
Yeah,
and to parse
you're one
it
person.
I think that's why it's a lot harder for women of color in a lot of ways, because, you know, we do live in a world that's still very much anti-woman in many ways, in terms of how we treat women, in terms of how sexism is still very much endemic in the culture. And then blackness, you know, especially in America, is always this kind of elephant in the room, or this kind of thing that we don't really want to address. So I think when you layer all that onto black women in particular, it makes it a very, it's a super, a lot of pressure in this identity, because you really don't have any of the privileges. And then you add in the poverty. I come from a very impoverished neighborhood. It's stressful. It makes you very tired, because you're constantly having to deal with all of these curveballs that are thrown at you because of your identity. So I don't think there's any way to parse it out, but I can tell you that the combination and the weight of all of it is very stressful and tiring.
Where did you grow up?
Cleveland.
And you grew up living with your mom, who also right. comes up in the show. Mm-hmm. You talk with us, the audience, about how your mom talked with you about
mm-hmm.
sex.
Mm-hmm.
Will you just share her advice with us, all of us?
Her basic advice was to leave all of the men's alone. And that's how she said it. She calls them men's. And she said, leave these men's alone. Ain't none of them no good. And, she would repeat that over and over to me when I was younger. And she still is like that. She still believes that. And that's just because she went through so much abuse at the hands of men, you know, that she really didn't want me to go through that. So she tried to, you know, instill upon me to avoid those traumas that she went through.
Well, after seeing the show, I started talking with some various friends about how did your parents talk with you about sex, trying to understand what people's different experiences
right.
were with that conversation, because it is so awkward.
Right.
And I've got a daughter who at some point I'm going to have that conversation, probably sooner than I'm prepared to do.
Mm.
But it was really interesting. Most of them said, oh, my mom just said, don't do it.
Mm.
Just don't have sex. That'll make everything a lot easier.
Interesting.
So, yeah. So yeah. It's a good conversation starter.
Mm.
Has your mom seen the show?
She has. She saw it in January. So I did it in Cleveland back in January at a theater there. And she loved it. She brought my father. She brought a bunch of people from the neighborhood. You know, they both have canes, my mother and my father. So when they got up to do the Beyonce dance thing, I looked over in the audience and they're both dancing with their canes. It was really, really a magical and wonderful experience.
What was the process like developing this story for the stage? I mean, you're really talking about a lot of personal stuff.
Yeah, I didn't think that I was going to be talking about all this personal stuff. I thought it was going to be a much lighter, funny show just about dating. But when I got into the show and I started developing it, all of these personal traumas started coming up. And I realized very quickly that I was writing a very different kind of a show. And I just kind of let the process drive me. So when stuff came up in me, I wrote it down, I rehearsed it, I put it in front of my script development director, David. And, it's a lot of rewriting. You rewrite, you put it in front of peers, they give you feedback, you put it in front of peers again, you make cuts, and then you get kind of this baby form of a show. And then you just start running it, and the audience tells you everything else that you need to know, what's working, what's landing, what's not. It's a grueling process. You know, by the time you guys get there, it has gone through so much work, and I've probably rehearsed this like thousands of times at this point. And it's really a demanding process.
So the show has, as of this conversation, has been running for 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about the Beyonce dance, bringing in the audience. That was something new. I mean, is it the same show night after, you know, each of the mm-hmm. nights that you mm-hmm. perform it twice a week? I mean, or has it continued to evolve?
So the content hasn't changed much. So the story that I'm telling is pretty much still the same. But how things are expressed each night varies greatly depending on the audience. So sometimes it's more emotional if people in the audience come and they have open hearts and they really connect to the material. Sometimes certain things are more funny. You know, people really come and they're laughing, especially if I get audiences that are very vocal. That changes the whole feel and the dynamic of the show. So those factors are different from night to night, but the content pretty much hasn't changed for the whole run.
What does it take to keep getting up there week after week?
You know, I have a lot of spiritual practices that keep me fresh.
Share.
Well, you know, I do a lot of meditation and cathartic practices. Somebody asked me last night, she was like, I can't believe you've been running this for this long because it feels like so fresh and like the first time, yeah. You know. And the reason for that is because when I perform this show, what I'm doing is channeling the energy of the audience. So I'm so present with them that whatever they give me, I'm responding to. And that's what creates the freshness. I'm not just, you know, saying stuff that I've memorized. I'm not just getting up there reading a script. I'm actually allowing the content to go through me in a different way night after night based on the reaction that the audience is giving me. So that's what keeps it fresh and alive and, you know, feeling like it's the first time every show.
Well, let's go back in time for a second to just graduating from Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And you got what I've never heard of anyone having this job. You were hired at the NYPD.
Well, it wasn't the NYPD.
Okay, tell.
I worked for the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the CCRB, which used to be part of the NYPD in like the 70s or something. And then it became an independent organization. Quote unquote independent.
Okay. And what was your job?
So I was an investigator. So this was my first job out of college. I investigated members of the New York City Police Department for allegations of misconduct.
What were some examples of investigations that you had to conduct?
So I had, you know, most of my complainants were young Black and Latino men. I would say like 80% of my complainants. And I had a lot of abuse cases. So, you know, allegedly an officer punched somebody in the face or pushed somebody or did something physical that they weren't supposed to do. There were cursing cases. So officers aren't supposed to curse.
Oh, I didn't know
that. So that becomes an allegation that they can get punished for. Had a lot of those. I had a lot of illegal strip search cases. So people alleging that they were strip searched in the middle of the street, full on. We had the Sean Bell case. I didn't personally have that investigation, but our agency investigated that as well. So that was the case that happened around, I don't know, 2006-ish, 7-ish. He was killed on his wedding night by a bunch of cops. So we, you know, we run the gamut. Any misconduct cases we got, except for stuff of a sexual nature. So if there were like sexual allegations, we didn't investigate that. That went to IAB.
And what prepared you to do that job? I mean, did you have to train for that? I mean, that sounds so intense.
I had no idea what I was walking into. You know, in my mind, I had just graduated from Dartmouth. I was going to go save the world. I was going to, like, you know, make all these changes. So you really aren't prepared for that kind of a job. So I learned everything on the job. We had mentors. So I had a mentor investigator who taught me how to investigate cases, what we were looking for, how to build evidence, how to do interviews, and then you shadow people. And then eventually you learn the craft. I mean, it's, you know, it's like anything that once you've observed enough, you start to integrate those skills. So I felt like within maybe like 6 months, I was very clear on what I was doing and how to conduct proper investigations.
I mean, it clearly is still so relevant now. Mm-hmm. Police misconduct is in the headlines every single day, particularly against populations of color.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that as you have personally experienced talking with these police officers about what they've done? What, I don't know, any insight you could share in terms of what's going on now?
You know, that's complicated.
Yeah.
What I can tell you is there are two things. There were a lot of good cops. So there were a lot of guys that really were just trying to do their job and, you know, people make a complaint and they get caught up in it. I met a lot of good cops who were trying to do their job. I met a lot of crooked cops who it was clear that they were egregiously abusing the law. Some of those cops have been fired now because they, you know, had a buildup of cases. And the other thing that I can tell you is that, you know, the police are really protected. The NYPD is basically a small army. And there are so many protections from the mayor's office, from all these different places, that there really is kind of this ability to abuse minority populations until it builds to this level of rising in the press like it did with the stop and frisk, which is an egregious policy in New York City, where they were literally just stopping thousands of young Black men and giving them these random tickets, and they hadn't even done anything. And that kind of stuff, you know, it's allowed to continue because the police are so powerful and they're protected, and because we're so segregated here. So because it doesn't impact, you know, the majority of, I don't know, middle class white Americans or rich Americans, then it doesn't become an outrage until it becomes truly outrageous. Mm-hmm. And even then, when you have video of what's happening, what happened with the young man in Chicago, somebody was recently just killed in San Francisco. He had a knife, he stabbed somebody, and then the cops just shot him dead. And he was just over there and they shot him dead. I think it's complicated. And I think unless we start to have more checks and balances on the police department and we start to care about what's happening in minority communities as a society, then these kinds of things keep happening.
Well, how did you go from that to performing? How did you go from working for this investigative unit to performing on the stage?
That was a long road. So after I was an investigator, then I kind of got into some corporate secretary work because I wanted to get paid and I was done saving the world. But then I heard about this opportunity called Challenge Day. They had a show on MTV called If You Really Knew Me that followed their work around the country. And I just saw it and I said, I should be doing that. And they happened to have auditions that week that I found it. I submitted an application, got accepted, packed a suitcase and moved to California. That's exactly how it came within 2 weeks.
Wow, timing.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was really perfect. And so I did that job for about 2 years. I traveled the country doing this workshop. And in the process of that work, I had to tell my life story for about 15 minutes. And I just realized how powerful and impactful storytelling was. And I started to look for other venues. And then somebody told me about The Marsh, and I started writing the show.
So I hear there may be a book in the works for you.
Yeah, so I recently got a literary agent from New York, and I'm hoping to have a book out by the end of this year and another show by August of this year.
Well, Echo, what's the best advice about storytelling that you've ever received?
The best advice that I've ever received. You know, this is going to sound very narcissistic. But I would say the best advice is the advice that I give myself all the time. That's so narcissistic. I'm sorry.
I wouldn't call that narcissistic. What do you tell yourself?
I tell myself to keep it real, keep it authentic, and keep it funny. And I think that's working for me.
Well, thank you, Echo Brown, joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was solo performer Echo Brown. Her one-woman show, Black Virgins Are Not for Hipsters, plays at The Marsh in San Francisco through the end of February. For more info, we've posted a link to her show at inflectionpointradio.org. And a special thanks to Tess Brustein for suggesting we talk to Echo Brown. That's our inflection point for today. Is there a woman changing the status quo you'd like to hear from? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point, just like Victoria Whitworth, Natalie Smith, and Jan Sterling, who are helping bring the voices and views of powerful women to the ears of everyone. And you can too at inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced at the studios of KALW Radio in San Francisco and delivered to public radio stations nationwide through PRX. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.